Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Today we offer another installment in our Museum Confidential podcast series, which is co-created twice a month by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum. We just completed our second season for this popular podcast, and we bring you the season two finale today, which was recorded last month in New Orleans before a live audience as part of the American Alliance of Museums, an annual conference and expo that draws thousands of museum professionals from all over the country. And for our presentation, we set up shop inside the beautifully furnished and mouth-watering Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. And our guest was Don Wildman, host of the long-running show on the Travel Channel called Mysteries at the Museum. Here again is Museum Confidential.
I'm Don Wildman. Take a walk with me. Let's solve a mystery.
The Rockefeller is one of the greatest names in American history, lost at sea.
Explain the unexplained.
Jefferson got what he wanted. He went up against insurmountable odds.
See the story from a whole new angle.
This was one of Ali's greatest feats.
And uncover the stories waiting to be told.
A basilisk is half rooster and half dragon.
Mysteries at the Museum on Travel Channel.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. For this special season finale episode, we headed down to New Orleans for a live show kicking off the annual conference for the American Alliance of Museums. If museums were Marvel superheroes, the AAM would be kind of like our shield. We set up shop inside the Southern Food and Beverage Museum for a chat with Don Wildman, host of the popular Travel Channel show Mysteries at the Museum.
Thank you very much.
Hey,
how great to be here.
I want to start kind of at the 50,000-foot level and just say, where did you grow up?
Outside of Philadelphia.
And, Philadelphia has some great museums. Mm-hmm. Did you go to museums a lot as a kid?
Yes.
Did your parents take you to museums? What did museums mean to you as a young person?
I can talk the entire show about this. I was the son of a man who was a history teacher first before he became an education administrator. And so his five children were dragged in tow to every battlefield and a historic house and museum up and down the eastern seaboard while camping in a small tent trailer, five of us. And we would go to campgrounds just off the battlefields, and we would see and we would walk these things. And it was this life of imagining what really wasn't there by virtue of, you know, the dioramas and my father's descriptions. In Philadelphia, where we were from, we were a Quaker family. And so we go way back in the hundreds of years in Philadelphia. So my father was very proud of the Franklin Institute and the Academy of Natural Sciences, the Philadelphia Art Museum, of course. But then there's so many more. And we were just constantly toured through those places. It was just cool to do that. And that set us apart, I remember. I didn't have a lot of friends who had parents who made that such a premium, but it was a big part of our life.
And you've turned that pursuit into a career, and you travel the world doing this now. How many seasons of the show have there been now?
23.
23 seasons.
I'm not kidding.
Let's hear it for that. 23 seasons, yeah.
Let me explain that. The reason 23 is over a lifespan of 8.5 years. It was important and popular enough a show to the audience that they wanted two original shows every time it was on. So 2 hours as opposed to 1 hour. And so we were basically doing two seasons at one time all the way along. Plus, there was Mysteries at the Monument. Then there were Greatest Mysteries. And then there were specials, Mysteries at the Museum specials. I've done over 400 shows in this format of using artifacts as the linchpin of a story, you know, and that basically was the formula of the show. Very tight, very predictable formula, 6 stories per show. We've done over 1,800 stories for that series.
The possibilities are probably somewhat endless. You never probably run out of ideas.
Never. There's a billion artifacts in American museums, roughly speaking.
When the show was first coming together, of course, you probably had to do a pilot or some kind of pitch to put the whole deal together. What was the first item or the first idea that was presented, say, to the Travel Channel or to the network to say, this is kind of what the show is going to be?
It's a good question, but I wasn't in the first season. Jay Thomas, the sitcom actor, now deceased, was the narrator. And it was a very, very simple show, being that there was no host, there was no personality involved. And I was doing another show called Off Limits at the time. And they decided that bringing the off-limits audience to the mystery show, the museum show, might be a healthy thing to do, and it turned out to be a good idea. Early on, it was very, very history, and then it moved more to mystery, and then it moved to aliens, and then it moved to paranormal, and then it moved to murder, and there were like all these eras. I was happy at some point, then I was sad the next season. I was a little grim the next season after that. No hair on the face the next season. It just kind of went through this evolution that was having to do with who was in charge and the different, you know, eras we were in and so forth. And it's been a really fascinating kind of blank canvas upon which, you know, we've painted a different show on this very dependable formula.
When's the moment where you hit your groove, you know, where you started to really feel it?
I got out of the clothes that I had been in for Off Limits because they had me as an explorer guy. And I shed that uniform and into kind of a fancy black leather coat that I picked out from Bloomingdale's. And at that point, it kind of...
I think that's where Indiana Jones got his, too. Right. Yeah.
And it kind of moved into more of a stylized thing. We also shifted, if you ever watch the old shows, they show them all over the place. The first series iteration was in a very small space in Queens, and that was very crowded. And then we moved into a more open space in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg. And that second place is where it really kind of found its more comfortable zone, I thought. You know, it just had more style. It didn't take it, it lost the pretense. We had so much in the beginning that was about me pretending that I was just off the street. You know, I was just exploring that jungle. Now I'm in here doing this. And it was just trying too hard to be both things at once. And once we finally gave over into the fact that I was presenting the show and it was, you know, a kind of formal formula, it kind of just found a comfort zone, which I was very comfortable with.
When you're doing media and you're providing an opportunity for a museum or a collection to have some light shine on it to kind of expose what its strengths are or some other things, usually that brings a lot of access. But do you run into barriers when you're wanting to do a show about a certain object or visit a certain place? Do people just welcome you with open arms every time?
You know what the unique thing that this audience and all museum people will understand is that the frustration behind museums is that they have so many artifacts that can't be included into most exhibitions. You know, museums always have 90% of their stuff behind closed doors. And so generally speaking, those curators and those managers were always very happy to say, "Ooh, we have this really cool one thing that you really want to see." And that show, we became the phone call that gave them that chance to show that thing off. Because our main goal with the show was to utilize the museum world as a showcase of storytelling and dramatic storytelling and protagonist-driven storytelling. Whereas most people think of museums as being sort of studied places where they go through a big, long arc of exhibitions and so forth, we were saying to them, no, each artifact is its own story. And when you talk to these experts who know these objects, they get really excited about it. And that's the look in their eyes when they're being interviewed on camera. It's this interesting thing. The world that I didn't even know we were in, I have now become more exposed to, which is object-based learning. Never even heard the term before the last few years. And it's become a very big subject, certainly in the museum world for kids especially, who are not used to thinking these days, sadly, of history in terms of objects. So object-based learning has become this very hot subject matter in the education world, the museum education world. And our show trades in that. It's object-based television.
You mentioned the fact that term really didn't exist. And since you've been doing the show, the world has changed in many, many ways just since you started doing it. and the way museums are thought about. Some of the collections that you deal with, there are now more questions than ever about how the museum acquired these pieces. Maybe some things were kind of ill-gotten. And also things dealing with cultural appropriation. And so the way you deal with subjects of the show, has that changed with the way the times have changed?
Not so much. I mean, I wish that we could take more time out of the formula and get more into the reality of the museum world and the cultural issues at hand. But it became a tighter and tighter ship, you know, as we went. The more successful it became, the more we traded on that success, rather than sort of stretching out the formula to accommodate those kinds of things. I was painfully aware of that stuff, especially when we did the specials. That's where I got a chance to get more cultural and more hands-on, so to speak, of the places we were at and talk to the experts firsthand. If you watch Mysteries at the Museum, it's deceptive. I'm the presenter. The truth of the show is that there are museums all over the place. There's no way I got to all those museums for that show, but it looks like I did. And it gives you that sense of immediacy just because I'm in and out of that format so much that it seems like I'm the guy driving this thing. But the truth is, all those experts and those museums are all interviewed by their own crews who've gone out there. I know a lot of those places because I followed up on a lot of those shows. I wanted to be a part of that world that we were sort of taking advantage of. But we didn't push the buttons that you're talking about so much. That was the cool thing. I mean, ironically, that's the cool thing to me. The museum world that I was so excited about being a part of vis-a-vis the show doesn't get that kind of commercial view so much. I mean, for better or worse, that's what we were doing. And it was just like any other subject matter, suddenly. And I loved that. I loved that kids were coming up to me, especially young people, who were just hooked on the show because they liked the stories. The fact that it was a museum show was secondary to them. And I said, oh, that's kind of good. That's kind of a sneaky way to get into their heads with this world that they will later encounter and get more interested in as grown-ups. But that was a really neat aspect of it for me.
My mom used to tell me two things, which I hated hearing at the time. One was, only boring people get bored. That was one. Because I would say, I'm bored all the time. And then the second one was, you're only interesting if you're interested. So you bring, of course, just a pretty large amount of curiosity generally to the projects that you do. Is that something that's always been there with you, or has it even grown the more you've done these projects?
Yes, it's grown a lot. I'm becoming aware that I have a personality disorder of some kind where I'm really obsessive about attaching connecting dots, and I've gotten to look at history as a kind of puzzle that I'm putting together for my own sake more than anybody else. I'm just like obsessive about it, and I love that. I love the whole endless puzzle that's going on here. And the older I get, the more I get like that. Like, I suppose everybody gets more what they are. My dad was very much that way. My dad he was on the edge a lot with all of this stuff. And so I think I've inherited his qualities, and I'm using them to a good end, but they're not all pretty. I bore my friends and family a lot, and I say that uncomfortably. I was driving along with my wife the other day, and I just found myself waxing poetically. We live in Westchester County, north of New York, and I was saying, the hydraulic grade line of the Croton Reservoir has to be 238 feet above the... And I literally heard my wife sigh, like, oh. And I just turned and I said, oh, I'm sorry, am I? That's where you realize...
We have to be aware of fun fact fatigue. It happens. I want to ask you about the problem we're facing in 2019. Not the downfall, but there is certainly a lack of interest in history kind of writ large. You know, it's not, you're not seeing as many people coming out of universities studying it. There's some things happening. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's a huge factor in society. I just read this very long article, I think it was in the Atlantic, and it was entitled No Case for Humanities. Did you see that? Yeah, it was a very long article about just coming right out and saying there's no defense for studying humanities. There never has been, and that's the point of the humanities. And it was a really fascinating take on it that was, you know, sort of sad to begin with, and then you get prouder if you're one of those people who comes from that world, which I am, you know. But it was hooking itself to the simple fact that there's a gigantic drop-off in interest in the humanities. But that's come and gone over time. That was the other point that they were making. Right now we're into this period of time where, I know my sisters are all grade school teachers, and they say all these kids have no time in elementary school to even talk about history. And so they're all in STEM programs to get them ready for testing and all that stuff. Necessary. I say, look at it from a not negative standpoint. It's just a fact of life. So how do you find other ways to get back into their heads with all of this stuff? I come from a state of New York. New York State, the Empire State, called itself that because it was so important, mostly to New Yorkers, that they were the primary driver of American culture in the 18th and 19th century, and on into the 20th, for sure. And so they began, it's the first state in the Union to have a state historian position, which I find so interesting. It was 1895, they created the State Historian Office in order to tell the story of New York. And this is a really complicated situation that exists because of basically it got really ramped up with World War I, which was really New York's war, and they wanted to tell the story of New York. So they created a whole system of local and regional historians. Today there's 1,200 of them.
Like this is a network.
It's a big network.
It stretches throughout the whole state.
The law that was passed in 1899 said every village, city, and town must have its own historian who will be able to tell that story of that village to the younger generations. And so that entire network answered to the state historian who used to be in the governor's office and now is in the state museum office in that administration. My friend, Devin Lander, is the 13th state historian of New York. And it's really an incredible history because back in the 1800s, it really starts with Washington Irving. 1809, Knickerbocker history, very famous, the first comedic satirical writing in American literature, right? 1809, big hit, and everybody read it. It made fun of the pretense of the Dutch and all of that which makes New York, New York, back in them. About 20 years later, a guy named William Smith, the son of that man, published the first official history of New York. And it started basically with the colonial history, the English. So the Dutch families, who were still very prominent in those days, got kind of pissed and they said, we need our story told. So they literally paid, they enacted a law, the powerful powers that be, enacted a law in New York to pay $4,000 to a man to go over to Europe and spend years collecting all the primary source material about the history of New York. And he did it in the mid-19th century. And he spent 4 years in England, France, and the Netherlands and collected a huge shipload of original primary materials. And those came home. And what happened was they needed somebody to translate a lot of that, to edit it, and to publish those papers. And that became the state historian. So I'm fascinated by the fact that some place really needed to take control of its history. You know, they took themselves so seriously that they needed to sort of master the story and take it over, which they did. And it really got told. I mean, there's a lot of things. I just bought a bunch of stuff on Amazon. You know, these original books, which you just don't even know if you're looking, unless you're looking for them. All that exists, and that told the story of New York. That's how passionate people were about history, you know, back in that time, before the world was taken over by technology.
Do other states have historians?
Yes, they do.
Is that something that's prevalent throughout the United States?
I think it is. I didn't do that research, but Devin tells me we were the first. New York was the first.
When you're traveling around and visiting other museums, one of the things I think people unfortunately pin on museums, and that's much different now than I think it was at the time, but you know, people will think, you know, what do they think about museums? They're quiet. Sometimes they think they're stuffy. They may think they're boring. There's some like these preconceived notions people bring with them. One of the things your show has done is kind of bring fun to it, bring, of course, a mystery element to it, but also kind of make it where you're kind of breaking down what we call either real or perceived barriers, you know? Making, you know, because some people may only be interested in history museums, but there's our art museums, there's museums for everything. What kind of feedback do you get from people? Do you actually hear people saying, I went to this place because it was on the show, or, you know?
There's a lot of that. I mean, I get a lot of Facebook and a lot of social media comes back to me about people's responses. And what's really heartening is how much loyalty they have to their museums. Same as me in Philadelphia. I mean, people just are proud of their museums and they grow up with these museums. And so they want to chime in on social media all the time. I get that a lot. Probably not as much as I should, and that's a condition of people not going enough to museums. I like museums myself because I walk through there. I mean, I think they're sexy places myself. I mean, it's just really about that for me. I get turned on in these spaces. They always do the same thing that great bookshops do for me or libraries do for me. I just find myself in a state of mind that's different from any other place. And I often ask myself, why is that? What is it, just me, or is that what happens in a museum for most people? And I think it's probably the latter. You're just suddenly subconsciously connecting dots and having new ideas floating through the netherworld of your head, unlike they do anywhere else. And that's an experience that really cultivates over a lifetime. I don't remember feeling like that when I was a kid. It was more like, what can I do? You know, running around so excited. But over time, it's that. To me, the museum business needs to trade a lot more on the lifespan of its attendee. You know, that this is a lifelong experience coming in there. I did this thing over in Berlin a few years ago, and it was a special conference of the special exhibitioners, those people who create the dinosaur shows and the NASA shows, those special commercial things that, you know, and that's a very controversial part of the industry, where theaters, it was really the Tut Show back in the 70s, created a new phenomenon where they could undeniably make money, but on the other hand became booking spaces. You basically moved in a show that then makes money and sells tickets, which is a good thing. And it's very exciting and it's all good. It's become a regular part of the industry. Well, who came along but Adam Gopnik's brother, I can't remember his name, but a man did the keynote for this thing and he says, I can't stand you people. You know, I'm happy to be here, thank you for bringing me over, but you're the problem. People don't have the same relationship with the permanent collections of their museums as a result of you guys booking your shows into these traditional spaces.
Is that because they're kind of getting this sugar high every few months where this phenomenon happens?
It's like...
They only go then, right?
Yeah, and there's a short-term thing that happens. They begin to view the museum as a theater, instead of as an ongoing, unique space that has the same things that they continue to go to throughout their lives and have different relationships with. I thought that was really fascinating. And ever since I've gotten involved in this, and I made a choice to do this. I'm a TV talent. You know, I happen to be a TV talent who had a past relevant to all the stuff that we're talking about, but I didn't need to do this stuff. I really saw it as an opportunity for myself to get deeper into a world that I really like. But I saw what was happening in the museum business vis-a-vis people like me who weren't in the museum business, who were sort of drifting away and seeing museums as only those banners on the street. What's new? What's exciting? What's in the New York Times this week? Instead of the ongoing feeling that you have. As soon as I started making a conscious choice of getting into it, both for my career and for my own self, I began to get reacquainted with that feeling that is completely unique to museums. That state of mind that I'm talking about, which is sort of a bliss for me.
When I was a kid, I would go to the library, and they always had posters at the library that were kind of, I think they said read, basically, and you'd see David Bowie on these posters. You'd see all kinds of celebrities that were outside of the book world, or, you know, they were pop cultural people. And, you know, I remember that. You know, it meant something to me, and maybe it was Alf. Who knows who it was on the poster? But it meant something to me. And like you said, you know, we don't see that a lot. And it would be an interesting idea, because the personal endorsement is important. If you're reading a book and someone asks you, they say, what are you reading? You tell them about that book. That's going to mean more to them than hearing about it on NPR, a trusted source telling you something. And in some ways, we do feel that with the celebrities and the people that mean a lot to us, the shows we watch, the movies we watch, the music we listen to. How could we get more celebrities on the side of museums, you know?
That amazes me too. I mean, if that is indeed the case, I'm not sure it is, but I haven't seen a lot. And I'm in there for a good personal reason. It seems like, for the same reason I said before, it ought to be noted to people that this is the coolest place on the planet. These buildings are amazing that you walk by. Why wouldn't you be wanting to be seen in there? It's sort of a no-brainer. I don't know why it's not happening. It sure happens at the Met Gala, you know? I mean, sure.
Well, the Met Gala, that's an interesting idea. So how can we take that concept and disperse it throughout the country?
That's a brilliant thing. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, as sort of eye-rolling as it can be, you know, it's sort of so hyper-celebrity now, it's actually a really smart thing. That's for the fashion part of the, you know, it's a very specific department that gets more notoriety than anything else just because they thought of doing that, and they have Anna Wintour. You know, I mean, it's a big deal. But I imagine that can be done everywhere in the world at some sort of scale, you know.
I think a good way to start might be a poster with Don Wildman saying, museums are sexy. I think that was the takeaway quote.
I'll take
of the
my
night.
Shirt
I think we
off
all agree
that.
About that, yeah. Let's hear it for Don Wildman, everybody. Yeah, thank you. This is great.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by the Ironclad and Universal Museum Policy, no food or drink in the galleries. You never want to be looking at a beautiful de Kooning painting, marveling at the colors and textures, and suddenly realize that the big orange swath isn't actually paint. Rather, some bozo touched it with Cheeto fingers. Cheeto fingers! Are you kidding me? And it's not just the mess. No one wants to hear you crunching on corn nuts either. No food or drink in the galleries. Not now, not ever, not gonna happen.
There's a new museum in New Orleans. It's a house. There's black mold on the ceiling, water damage, forgotten toys piled up, and furniture upended. A reminder of what happened in August 2005. But this is not a remnant of Katrina. It's an installation by artists Aaron Angelo and Ken Connor. They spent hours painstakingly recreating what the homes looked like after the levees failed. A faux physical reminder of a real American tragedy. It is called, quite simply, the Flooded House Museum. In a recent Washington Post article on the project, a Canadian tourist said, "Like any disaster, if we don't remember, then it could happen again. If we remember, then we can maybe prevent it or get through it a little better the next time." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
And that again is Museum Confidential. You can listen to any of our Museum Confidential podcasts for free online at publicradiotulsa.org. When you go there, just look for the podcast tab and again select Museum Confidential. Also, you can find this podcast at iTunes, Spotify, and the NPR One app. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thank you for tuning into Studio Tulsa.